many of our children and youth that are carrying in significant adversity and trauma are really coming into our schools with an activated nervous system. And the punitive practices of kicking out, sending out, referring out, isolation, seclusion, those punitive practices actually exacerbate the trauma. And our discipline data tells the story.
Welcome to the Society's Child podcast, where we have real conversations about being a trauma-responsive educator in the midst of a significant mental health crisis. Hi, I'm Trish Senzak, a former educator, compassion advocate, and Jesus lover, and I'm so grateful that you're here. Are you feeling confuzzled about your students' behavior and needs? You're not alone. If trauma-informed strategies leave you wondering, what's next? Don't worry. My friend, I've been there too. As a foster mom and a child of complex trauma mixed with my experience as a teacher, it's led me to finding a compassionate, whole child approach that's evidence-based, practical, and transformational, and I'm so eager to share it with you. Whether you want to connect with your students on a deeper level, create a trauma-sensitive environment, or you just need a little bit of encouragement or support, you're in the right place. So grab a drink, a pen, or your earbuds, and let's work together to create a safe and student-attuned, trauma-responsive school culture. Society's children need you, so let's get started.
Welcome back, friends. I am excited again to give you part two of the interview with Dr. Lori DeSottles. If you did not get a chance to go and listen to the previous episode, part one with her, I really want to encourage you to do that. In that episode, we learned so much from her. She talked about survival states and how we should befriend our autonomic nervous system. And she gave us a good idea of felt safety. And the last thing that we talked about was borrowing someone else's calm or steadiness in that sense of co-regulation. That actually helps others learn to emotionally regulate their own nervous systems. There's so much gold and wisdom and nuggets in that previous episode. I really want to encourage you to go back and listen to it. And she has much more where that came from. Let's get right to part two.
Can you share just a few concrete techniques or actionable
Yes.
things about co-regulation? So a teacher might know exactly like, okay, well, what does this mean? And how do I borrow someone's calm?
Yeah. So when I know that a student is struggling, and I want to talk about getting out in front of the behavior before we finish today too. But if I noticed that there is growing negative, big emotion, an example of co-regulation is, offering, like sitting down, giving a student a bottle of water while I drink some water too. So it's, we're both doing this together. Co-regulation can be taking a walk together, not even talking. Co-regulation could just be sitting beside a student. And just, again, our nonverbal, so we are in a place where we can share that calm through our face, through our tone. Co-regulation can be practices that you can do with a student, and you can plan those out ahead of time. In fact, I'm working on my new manual right now, and it's called dual drawing. And so I have a sheet of paper, and my student has a pencil, I have a pencil, and I make a shape on a paper, the student adds to it, and we agree we won't talk for 1 minute. And then together, we just keep adding lines and shapes to this paper. And then at the end of a minute, we look at it together, and we see what we've created. Now, the tricky part is that in many of our schools, co-regulation can be misunderstood, and it looks like we are rewarding negative behavior. So, if a student is in this survival state and we're walking with them, or we're offering water, or we are sitting beside them and gently sharing our nervous system, we traditionally, as educators, have seen discipline in punitive ways. So this co-regulation and rewarding negative behavior can be very misunderstood. So co-regulation is actually helping the child get to the cortex, to be able to reason, to be able to repair, to be logical. If a child tears up a room and I'm consequencing them in my survival state and they're in survival, then it's only going to get bigger. And we're going to be back at it the next day or the next hour. So co-regulation is allowing time and space so that the teacher and the student are in their cortex so that they can repair together. They can discuss, share, be creative with options. What will we do the next time this happens? And it takes time. But we traditionally are not prepared to look at discipline through that lens.
I so agree. Wow, thank you. The traditional approach is a dying hard kind of thing, isn't it?
Very, very much. And I want to give grace to teachers because, you know, we do as best as we can with what we know. And unfortunately, in our world today, these practices that are about the application of educational neuroscience and polyvagal theory are not taught in pre-service education. I think we're moving in that direction, but we are still preparing educators in traditional, behaviorally focused ways. And the behavior is only a signal. It is an indicator that the nervous system is struggling. So we have to meet our kids where they are. And this takes time. It takes preparation. So discipline is your morning meeting. Discipline is your bell work. Discipline is the first 10 minutes of your day. How are you getting out in front of a child's behavior and building engagement? How are we setting, how are we bringing their nervous system into the present moment and checking in with them? And giving them an opportunity to share anything that's on their heart or mind. So those are the practices that we're cultivating in our schools right now. That's discipline. It's not reactionary, and it's not always about consequences. It's always about consequences, but not those punitive consequences that come out of survival states.
I love hearing you say that. It's about consequences. So a lot of times this movement has been given a passive lens, and thinking that the consequence or that the student gets a pass, when in essence, there still is a consequence. Life is about truth, you know, situations and consequences, right? And then in this situation, it's really about building and scaffolding and having that new language that we're learning as we get there. So that still they're accountable, but in just a different way and less punitive. Did I get all that right?
Yes, you did. And I want to add to this too, in that many of our children and youth that are carrying in significant adversity and trauma are really coming into our schools with an activated nervous system. And the punitive practices of kicking out, sending out, referring out, isolation, seclusion, those punitive practices actually exacerbate the trauma. And our discipline data tells the story. So for our teachers listening to this podcast today, the children and adolescents that were struggling in August are probably the same students struggling in February. We don't have a whole new group of kids with office referrals, kickouts, suspensions every week. So we really, our discipline data shares the story of how we are integrating either punitive practices that keep the behavior moving along the same pathway, or are we teaching the behaviors that we want to see? And the last thing I'll say about that too, is that it's a mindset shift for the adults. Behavior management is about adults. It is not about kids. I have the ability, and I have, Trish, I have escalated everybody around me in my own home and in a classroom unintentionally because I was in survival. I also have the ability to co-regulate everyone around me in my own home and in a classroom through my awareness of my nervous system state. And if we think about consequences as experiences, it changes the game. So instead of asking what consequences does the student need when they run out of my room, we need to be asking what experiences can we create so that this child will not need to run out of the room. That's felt safety. Mm. What experiences can we create so when the student walks in, they don't feel the need to tear up the room? How do we change the culture? How are we meeting our students where they are socially and emotionally? It's much more than social and emotional learning. It is the neuroscience, the neuroeducation of the nervous system.
Mm, I love that. Wow, beautifully put. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Wow. So this is a movement that is really taking, at least when it caught me, it just really settled in my soul in a place of wow. And I know that there's still a lot of resistance out there to moving towards the trauma-informed, or even listening to these kids. We just kind of want to push them aside and keep doing what we're doing. What encouragement or hope would you offer someone who might still be resistant to this and really is set in their ways?
So first of all, I would validate the resistance. And I would validate the resistance because we as human beings are creatures of habit. And how we have learned, how we have perceived our worlds, our own mind maps have been generated over a long period of time. So I want to give educators that grace to know that it's really challenging to move from what we know to a very unknown area. And because we feel a sense of loss, we feel a sense of loss of power, we feel a sense of loss of control. And this was not the way that we have been conditioned to teach. So it's never adding to an educator's plate. It's really about integrating all day long ways that we can help our students to feel seen and heard and to embody their own unique strengths and autonomy and agency. So I start with validating the resistance, because resistance is just fear. That's what it is. It's fear. So just recognizing your resistance is huge.
And isn't that validation of seeing though, you know, doing that validation, the same thing as we're asking to be able to do for the kids, is to see them and hear them.
Same thing. Same thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what would you, in closing, what would you share in terms of, we've covered some elementary things here in the very basics of becoming trauma-informed, stepping in with our kids, and being able to put this stuff in practice. So you've done some really advanced work and have come a long way with your compassion over consequences and the different work that you're doing, and you're looking at neuroplasticity and how we can change. Can you share a little bit about that and the hope that's coming in terms of the fact that there is hope and that we can change the way we think and how we're approaching them?
Well, I do feel like there's hope, because the pandemic actually a few years back has kind of opened kind of the doors for, it was a movement. It was a pandemic that actually kind of shared how our communities and schools and children and educators, how we were really struggling even before that pandemic. I mean, there were growing numbers of children that were feeling, and adolescents through the CDC that were, you know, feeling anxious and depressed. And so the pandemic really opened our eyes to possibilities. So as we think about our nervous systems being an integrated system and really being our best friend, and I mean that, like if we can befriend our nervous systems, we begin to move from nervous system states of protection into nervous system states of growth. And that's neuroplasticity. And I think neuroplasticity, and we teach this to our children, We have several superpowers as human beings, but neuroplasticity is a superpower. And our nervous system is always listening to us. Our brain is paying attention to where we place attention and intention. And so I tell my students and I tell my families that if you go home every day and you sleep, that's what your brain gets good at. If you go home every day from school and you're gaming, that's what your brain gets good at. If you are, and I tell my staff, if you are a chronic complainer and, you know, that's what you do, then you get very good at that. Because neuroplasticity is defined as every experience structurally and functionally changes the nervous system, not just the brain, the nervous system in all moments. So if we practice worrying, we get good at worrying. If we practice basketball, we get good at basketball. And this is my hope. It goes deeper than growth mindset. And this is resiliency. And we have this ability.
Wow. What you have shared with us is gold today. Where can people learn more about what you're doing?
So my website is revelationsineducation.com. And it is a very large website that is for parents and educators. Most of the resources, 90% of them, you can download immediately. They're free. You can access just so many practices for the nervous system as an educator. There are posters, there's artwork, there are videos. You can contact me. I mean, it really is a wonderful place to begin looking for resources to support this shift in actually the title of my newest book, Intentional Neuroplasticity, Moving Our Nervous Systems and Educational System Toward Post-Traumatic Growth.
I love that. I love that so much. And I'm eager to follow you and to see what, you know, you end up growing, because it's been interesting watching your journey as you've, you know, started to where you are now, and there's hope in all of your writing. So I will leave all of this information. You're welcome. Thank you. There's a lot. And I will leave all this information in the show notes for anybody who wants to look it up and find more information. And there's a great amount of infographics and all kinds of stuff on her website. So go check it out and really just take a minute to learn from her. Any last words, Lori?
No, thank you, Trish, so much for having me. This has been a really fun conversation. Thank you so much.
Me too. Thank you. I think so too. And I'm so grateful for you. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
So friends, I hope you found something in one of those episodes that you can take back to your classroom. Our kids need this. With this trauma-informed movement, it is so imperative that we learn how to see our kids for the things that they're going through. We need to really look at how to create the felt safety, how to co-regulate with them, how to really be in touch with our autonomic nervous system. I am so grateful for Dr. Lori and all that she's doing, and I hope that you found this helpful. I know that your jobs are not easy, and that is why I'm here for you, because I really want to empower you to be able to work with the kids in a way that's different, that's unique, that gets the results that you want, because I believe in this. And I believe that if we as humans can really embrace this movement, and not only learn how to become trauma-informed, but seriously become trauma-responsive, our kids will grow up with a brand new language that I believe will transform this world. No matter where you are, I believe there's something that we can take away from this. And the work that Dr. Lori is doing, I think, is groundbreaking. It's pivotal for what we need to know as educators. Please make sure that you go check out her information on her website. I will leave everything in the show notes for you. In the meantime, my friends, if you're looking for ways to build more peace in your career, I've created a list of 75 affirmations based on 25 Bible scriptures, and I'd love to share it with you and help you keep your sanity. You can go to trishz.com/Bible-AFFS. That's AFFS for affirmations. I'll also leave the link in the show notes for you too. Until next time, my friend,
Stay grounded, stay regulated, and stay prayed up. Hey, amazing educators, thanks for tuning in. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love for you to hit subscribe and leave a review. Even better, share this episode with a colleague. And hey, I'd love to connect with you on social media. You can even join my Facebook group for some extra support and a dash of inspiration. I've left all the links in the show notes. Until next time, my friend, remember, you're not alone on this journey. You've got this. Keep making a difference and stay teach-tastic.